Or agreeing to allow us to appear before you to engage with this committee on the review of Section 25 of the Constitution. I'm supported here today by some fellow net bankers. I'll give the presentation and they'll help me respond to the Q&A. On my right is our Chief Operating Officer and Executive Director, Mfundo Nkuhlu. To his right, Dennis Dykes, our Chief Economist. And then to his right again, our Group Executive for Strategy, Priya Naidu. You should all have in your possession our full 28-page submission. And I'm also sure that throughout these past few days of hearings, you've heard much from many stakeholders on the why nots and the risk of changes to the Constitution. We aren't here only to alarm you about these potential risks or lament as to what hasn't worked. We do hope that our presentation is realistic on the economic impact assessments, but we will also focus on what, in our opinion, can be done to make sustainable and economically beneficial land reform implementable in a way that is pragmatic, effective, constitutional, transparent, rules-based, and offers certainty and predictability based on the merits of each case in respect of each piece of land in question. As a leading player in the banking industry, we felt that it was imperative that you hear directly from us. And we can clearly only speak for and on behalf of NEDBANK. Our recommendations on land reform, including the question of if a constitutional amendment is required to achieve more effective implementation thereof, including expropriation without compensation, has in its genesis our role as a bank and the role of a bank in the broader transformation of our society. We are one of South Africa's largest commercial banks. We are an engaged corporate citizen. It is both our moral and business imperative to fulfill our transformative role in South Africa and in so doing to help improve the lives of all our citizens. We strive to remain relevant and a growing partner to society. In our role as a bank, we do this primarily by transforming the savings and deposits of our citizens, companies, institutions, and governments into investment and productive consumption, and so doing to facilitate inclusive economic growth, employment, wealth creation, and transformation. In this context, property and land specifically as a capital asset and as the basis of security is a key enabler of this role of a bank. It provides the security for many loans that we make, thereby safeguarding the country's savings and deposits and ensuring the safety and soundness of our financial system. As South Africans, we believe we have a constitutional duty to recognize and redress the injustices and inequalities of our past, while simultaneously working to build a society that is based on the rule of law and aims to improve the quality of life for all our citizens. These injustices and inequalities are apparent in all parts of the economy and in land ownership, which reflect our history of conflict, colonialism, segregation, and apartheid. As a result, it's clear to us that land distribution and ownership is skewed along racial lines. Therefore, as a leading commercial bank and a partner in society, we recognize the national imperative of changing these skewed and unequal patterns of ownership affecting land reform in a way that is constitutionally based, orderly, pragmatic, and sustainable, which contributes to and unlocks higher and more inclusive economic growth, which safeguards food security and does not create systemic risk to the financial sector and, as a consequence, damage the economy. Whatever the recommendations and conclusions that this Honourable Committee may arrive at, including prospective legislation, interventions and amendments, NEDBANK would want to work with the state to make sure that effective, sustainable and an economically beneficial model and program of land reform is implementable. NEDBANK believes that the Constitution already strikes a careful and well-considered balance between the need to protect ownership and the need to ensure land reform and address the inequalities caused by our history. In our opinion, the Constitution has to date not been an impediment to the lack of progress on land reform. In our opinion, there is no deficit in the legal powers provided to the state by the Constitution and in existing legislation to expropriate land for land reform purposes. However, they have not been adequately promoted or enforced. Section 25 of the Constitution places restrictions and oversight on the ability of the state to expropriate private property. It recognizes the importance of the right to own property and to be protected against the arbitrary deprivation thereof as a fundamental right. It is one of the pillars of our legal and economic system. As a result, it underpins much of the safety and soundness of our financial systems. The right to own property is not, however, absolute, and the state is entitled to expropriate property provided it is in terms of a law of general application for a public purpose or in the public interest, and subject to a just and equitable compensation with the important protection of judicial oversight. In our opinion, the Constitution should therefore not be used as a scapegoat for the real reason for our lack of sufficient progress on land reform. As the chief executive of one of our big banks, I certainly understand my obligations, not only to the 8 million clients who entrust us to protect their hard-earned savings, but also to the safety and soundness of our entire financial system and economy. The stability of the banking sector is an extremely valuable national asset, which contributes to the assessment of our country's investment ranking, it lowers borrowing costs, and ensures funding availability for governments, companies, and individuals alike. This is particularly important in South Africa, where we have a fiscal and current account deficit. That means we spend more than we earn, and we import more than we export. And as a result, we are reliant on external borrowings to balance the books of our country. As a commercial bank, we are a key role player in funding the economy. And any material negative impact on property prices would adversely impact confidence in the banking system and could trigger a classical banking crisis, starting, unfortunately, with the smaller banks and the land bank, and possibly migrating to bigger banks, with significant negative knock-on effects to the economy. Every bonded property that is expropriated without compensation is likely to result in a direct impairment to that loan on the balance sheet of the lending bank, even if such loans do remain technically, legally due and payable. In addition, municipalities would be impacted in terms of rates and taxes. So for indicative purposes, and you've heard some numbers earlier, for Nedbank, an assumed expropriation of 10% of Nedbank's 153 billion Rand residential mortgage book would result in a direct impairment charge of a minimum of 15 billion Rand. As Nedbank only has 14.5% market share in residential mortgages, impacts for our peers would be larger than this. Our exposure to commercial property is 162 billion Rand, and our exposure to agriculture, 17 billion. Banking crises everywhere in the world start on the asset side of the balance sheet. As a bank, we'd be left with few options in order to protect our capital and our depositors. These include possibly shrinking our balance sheets, constraining credit to other sectors of the economy, or in extreme circumstances, requiring government intervention. The latter, as we have seen around the world, coming at a cost to taxpayers to protect depositors. Maintaining confidence in the banking system is absolutely imperative for depositors to feel that their money is safe. This directly affects the level of the currency, our sovereign debt ratings, and the value of investments held by pension funds, asset managers, and consequently every ordinary South African, including you and I. Global data shows us that the recovery from such crises are painful and costly and can be characterized by recession, higher unemployment, and spiraling public debt. We've seen an example of this in the aftermath of the global financial crisis. So as an aside, given the importance of this parliamentary process, I have just returned early from our international investor roadshows to make this presentation. I can assure you that the uncertainty in the investor community in respect of the outcome of this constitutional review process is already negatively impacting investor perceptions and investment in our country. The topic of expropriation without compensation and the lack of clarity as to exactly what this could mean was raised in every single investor meeting. Hence the importance for us to provide clarity and certainty as quickly as possible. In conclusion, Nedbank is certainly committed to working together with fellow South Africans to support an orderly process of ongoing land reform. And we propose a plan of concrete and considered steps along the following lines, which requires both the state and the private sector to work together. So to be clear, in our opinion, this does not require constitutional amendments. Firstly, we need a comprehensive and well-resourced model for land reform. And this needs to be predicated on actions to more effectively use existing instruments and powers of land reform and powers so that we don't further delay land reform in our country. Secondly, this requires legislative, regulatory and administrative frameworks with parliamentary and judicial oversight. And thirdly, the state working with the private sector to explore opportunities to provide improved and more holistic support for beneficiaries. We'd like to thank you for your time and we're happy to take any questions.
Thank you very much to Nedbank members. So, Korenov, Kata, Terezi, Rock, Honorable Mene, Honorable Paulsen, Honorable Koki, Honorable Mutapo, and Honorable Swan.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Thank you very much for the presentation from Nedbank. There is a debate, you know, a pro and a con debate with regard to whether there should be thousand seats or not. Now, some people say, or laymen, if your property are bonded, the bank will take it, you know, whether it's true or not. Some people will say, you know, as soon as the title deed is transferred from the municipality to the title deed, the new title deed holder, that property will be sold because of other household debt. So, you know, it is a debate. Now, what I want to ask you, if there is a caveat against that title deed, to say that in the first 10 years, you cannot sell this property, or if you sell it, the state will have, or the municipality will have, in this instance, if it's urban land, will have a right of first refusal. So you must sell it back to the state. So can I ask you, will that lower the value of the bank security if there's caveats like that?
Kaza?
Thank you, Chairperson. Would you say that the positive impact currently profited by government, whether it outweighs the negative impact from the bank's point of view? And then, just unfortunately, early on, my question wasn't really answered, so I'm going to ask it to Nedbank. What will the effect of expropriation without compensation be on your 8 million clients, their salaries, their savings that they are entrusting you with? Thank you.
Thank you, Justice. I've heard that Nedbank and also the previous session has been a lot with regards to the risk, the potential risk, the fact that the same people go this autopilot consortium will be there. And also, don't they think that already as a country we are in a risk where the majority of our people, in particular the banks, are not working? As a result, they lie on the stage in terms of the social grants. And they are health is dependent on the state in terms of public hospital and all this. And as a business, when they call a business as a potential risk, I believe they believe so much in taking risk as a business. Why in this regard they actually want the state if they consider it as a risk and the state is believing to is convinced rather that this process won't interfere and won't actually pose any risk.
Nedbank, you put it quite correctly at the beginning that of land in South Africa. And that leaves us with 90% of wealth in the hands of minorities, to which a majority of them is society. And the rest of the people that actually do all the things which the previous Buddha was talking about, to be empowered and everything else, that people that work the land. So when, if we get to the end of this whole process we are doing, and then it's expropriated without compensation, as a net bank, are you willing to come on board and work with government to assist in the process of ensuring that land is no longer a commodity, but everything else that we can do on top of the land, like building the structures, agriculture, and building factories and everything else is available, we will be able to come on board. And then secondly, you speak of the road shows or business shows you were doing abroad, but all of them, they do not, they all fail to look into other countries where the same system has been applied, like Singapore and China. And the systems there haven't failed. Nothing has failed. They invest this care and stress and everything else that investments are going to run away and everything. They haven't run away anywhere else. They are still there. And this system is there. It's implemented, it's working, it's successful. So why do they always put upfront that is our investment safe? What is this uncertainty? Because where this system has worked, no one left. Thank
you. President.
Thank you, Chairperson.
on slide 6.2, speak about reflective and regulatory certainty.
And also including an enabling policy, yet policies that benefit this business, and yet what sort of investment has this brought to the country, even though there's been an enabling policy. And then the other question is, in terms of Nedbank exposure, if we do expropriate land without compensation, and if we were to pass this amendment, if we were to amend this policy, or this section 25, would Nedbank work, commit to working with government to avoid that classical banking crisis that you speak of? Thank you very much, Chairperson.
Morakodi.
Thank you, Chair. I want to start by acknowledging the opening line that recognizes the historical context. Because without the historical context, we're not talking to the same issue. However, I might be reading your presentation to say, you know, beyond the acknowledgement of the important position of land, the body of your presentation is a lot of negative about what we should not do. Even the point on page 3 that says land reform, that is, and all the things that you could say, essentially, it's all about things that merely seeks to put the burden on those who want to see transformation. And very little on what you are suggesting needs to be done to address this very historical imbalance that you have spoken about. And I see on page 4, you're talking about Section 25 is amended concerns a very, you call it very strange and damaging amount to your people. And I'm thinking how my people will feel that. Or are we talking about the same people? And what does that say? What does that mean? once you started with, it's a historical context. But then when you go in, it's almost like you want to piece the space.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you
for the input. Taking it from where Honorable Mente and Godi left it, let me on page the third page, bullet number four, they say where you refer to our people. Is not that aware that majority of the people or our people are excluded from participating in the economy? And again, when one looks at this presentation, it's so scary, very scary, scaring everyone. It can also scare the market. And so intimidation. Especially when you look at page 5, look at excluded. And the comparison of this process with the effect of post-World War II, I don't think that is a very a good comparison per se. And I would like to know why do you go to an extent of making such a comparison? And on the last page, Chair, on page 6, the recommendation, especially the second one, I'm attempted here to sort of agree with you, but the manner in which you started the whole input, so to say, is very, very scary. And I hope that we all become part business and each and every interest in South Africa, we become part of this process in order to address the injustices of the past. Thank you, Chief.
Thank Tim and CEO.
I appreciate this, and I whilst it is, to me it's a wake-up call to us as legislators to understand the financial implications of a policy that is not thought to be careful on the land reform program. So, at ESCAR, these are the scenarios that we need to consider if we have a financial banking crisis. Saw the 2009 financial crisis that impacted us as well. So you're engaging with Parliament at the moment. My question is, given your approach to Section 25, which is in line with the Human Rights Commission's approach, with the custodian of the Bill of Rights, have you, like Agri South Africa, engaged with government, and are you continue to engage with government so that government clearly understands the implications of the, as you put it, the poorly implemented land reform program, given again the caveat that was put that any amendment to the Constitution will be done with fair consideration that must not impact the economy. Thank you.
Thank you, Mazeo, your substantial input.
Right, thank you very much. There are a number of questions there. I'll just start with the last one. Outside of the engagement that you heard Kaz talk about earlier through the Banking Association, Nedbank has not engaged directly with government on these issues. And we are using exactly this process to do that, submitting our submission and requesting to come and present here. So we'll share the questions amongst us, but just to start with the first one on title deeds, and the conversation around title deeds are something banks want to take to be able to sell assets. I'd just like to make a couple of things 100% clear. Firstly, in our residential mortgage business in Nedbank, a sale in execution is an absolute last resort. It is the worst outcome for the bank, and it's the worst outcome for customers. Over the last few years, as our customers have gone through a very, very difficult financial situation in our country, we've helped more than 30,000 customers who've got into arrears on their home loans. We've helped them manage that situation and remain in their houses. We try and work with our customers if they get themselves into a financial position that those arrears are unpayable. In the first instance, we try and work with our customers for them to sell the houses themselves, not the bank sell the house in the sale and execution. And in fact, when customers sell the houses themselves, Nedbank picks up 50% of the loan shortfall. And again, in the last few years, that has cost us 500 million rand in helping our customers exit their financial obligations. And then finally, very importantly, the bank did not profit on home loan repossessions. When we repossess as a last resort in a sale and execution, we set a reserve price on that property. We credit the customer with the reserve price. If the bank buys the property in and subsequently sells it at a profit, that profit is credited to the customer's account. So it is not in the bank's financial interest in any way to sell properties in sale and execution. And Puta, I don't know if you want to talk to the risk issue.
Yes. The question that was raised in relation to the potential risk that were highlighted was whether we do not recognize that there are existing risks already with people not involved in the mainstream of the economy. I think the point that we do recognize those risks, that the risk of lack of financial inclusion do undermine sustainable growth and development prospects for all citizens. As a consequence, too, we're drawing attention to the fact that the expropriation of land without compensation, as is contemplated in the review, should not have the effect of raising systemic risk to the soundness and stability of the financial system. Because if we're to do that, unfortunately, say it will create a higher order risk for all and sundry. It is evident, Chair, and we've seen this across the world, when systemic risks emerge to cause a banking crisis, the restoration and recovery of the financial system will take precedence and priority. So it will have the unintended effect of refocusing attention away, actually, from land reform to deal now with the new systemic risk that would have emerged. And this is what we are raising questions instantly.
Thank you. And then just to complete that, to some of the other questions, certainly the intention of our presentation was not in any way to be scary. The intention of our presentation, if you see what we said up front, is that we recognize the importance of land reform. We provide at the back end of our presentation practical ways that we think land reform should be executed, and we have said that we do want to be part of working with government in that process. I just believe that it is incumbent upon me, as the chief executive of one of the big four banks in this country, and therefore responsible for the safety and soundness of our financial system, to point out the consequences of poorly implemented land reform or wide-scale expropriation without compensation on the safety and security of our depositors' money. So perhaps, Dennis, if I could ask you just to talk through other countries and why we talk to this uncertainty and this has succeeded in other countries.
Thank you, Mike. I think just to develop the previous point as well, if you say to someone, if you run across a busy road, you might get run over by a car. I mean, it is a scary sort of consequence, but you feel that you should actually warn that person over the bet. And really, we've seen many, many of these sort of events in history which actually have very significant effects, which are entirely avoidable. So the examples that were brought up a little bit earlier on, I do find China to be a slightly odd example, because China has basically gone from total ownership of all property and has liberalized from around about 1978 with incredible consequences, where basically as property has actually spread into the private sector now contributes around about 70% of total GDP. So it's almost like a reverse example of what one would actually point to. Singapore, very peculiar circumstances, but to the best of my knowledge, not without compensation. Earlier examples that were spoken about, South Korea, the big expropriation that took place there was post the Second World War, with the invasion of the Japanese landowners. So very special circumstances. And farmers who were small scale anyway and who were greatly supported by the state. And consequently, it was a very successful example of basically expropriation. But as I say, quite different to our peculiar circumstances. So I think, you know, just when you look at the examples that we put down there, and it was just to illustrate what can go wrong and how long it does take to address the consequence of the banking crisis, where you would have seen that, for example, this is the average of banking crises in this period. So it's not the extreme, and it's certainly not, it wouldn't be a worst case or a best case. But you can see something like an 86% increase in your government debt, which incidentally the authors attribute more to the consequences of recession post an event that causes a collapse in property values, rather than bailing out of banks or depositors. It just gives you some sort of idea of how tremendously damaging this could be, in particular to government, because government would have less resources to actually spend. And we just think that there are better ways of doing it, rather than saying to the person, go across the road, let's pull that bridge, and let's do it together.
Okay, just to continue, perhaps just to reflect again back on the roadshow question that I had. One of the sort of litmus tests I always use on roadshows is we spend about an hour sitting with an investor. And generally speaking, that hour is split between a conversation about our country, a conversation about our industry, and then a conversation about Nedbank in particular. And the relative time spent on each of those gives you a litmus test of a concern for investors. So usually we would spend probably 20 minutes on the country, 10 minutes on the industry, and 30 minutes on our business. In the most recent roadshows now, on average we're spending 40 minutes on the country, 5 minutes on the industry, and 15 minutes on Nedbank as an investment opportunity. And actually one particular asset manager of a very large fund in the US, the entire meeting was spent on land reform. We didn't even get to talk about any other investment opportunity. And Pauline, if I could just ask you to reflect on the majority being excluded and how, what Nedbank is doing about that.
Certainly, thank you, Chair. If we recognize that starting point of the country and that an imperative for financial inclusion is to bring the majority into the mainstream, this is a serious underpinning of the transformation journey that our outfit has been on to. That is reflected in current accomplishments, where 80% of the staff is black, and the client base, 70% of that is black. Having said so, we would recognize, say, up front, that there's still much to do, both in the country and as the Nedbank specifically, to deepen and entrench progress on the transformation of the economy as a whole. It is with this in mind that we've actually committed to be part of this process and to participate in collaboration with the state in implementing the sound land reform program. We certainly committed to that, both because of our extension of credit in the market and exposure to properties and asset class,
but also because we think this is an underpinning of sustainable development into the future.
And therefore, having recognized the magnitude of the challenge, we're not shirking from our responsibility to be partners in finding the solutions.
And then finally, just to try the last question, I think given Nedbank's exposure to the South African economy, I've shared with you the exposure that we have to residential mortgages, to commercial mortgages and agriculture. Our total asset and liability base within South Africa is slightly in excess of R1 trillion. In the first instance, our job is to work alongside government and policymakers to minimize any risk that may arise as a consequence of our land reform process and to ensure that we do achieve an outcome that is truly an outcome that helps inclusively grow the economy and doesn't impact food security. I think the challenge from an investment point of view right now is that we have heard many things that this land reform process is not. We've heard that it's not going to be a land grab. We've heard that it's not an assault on property rights. We've heard that it will not impact on economy and food security. But what the investment community says, what is it? What is the, if there is going to be an amendment, what exactly is the wording that is proposed? And certainly Nedbank wants to be part of that process of ensuring that whatever the outcome is, it truly does increase economic growth and food security. And whatever the outcome, we have an obligation as a responsible corporate citizen to work alongside our other corporates and government in South Africa to create a better life for all South Africans. Chair, I think we've dealt with all the questions so far. I'm not sure if there are more.
Yes, thank you very much. Thanks to one of our corporate citizens, Nedbank. Thanks to the CEO for coming and participating in the process and enriching the community's work. Thank you very much for your time. Our next of the year, John Langalvarez Dube Institute in Corner. Dr. Ngo, all right. Yeah, as you come closer, Mr. Ngo. Thank you.
This institute was formed with the aim of carrying forward the ideals, values, and aspirations of the legendary statesman, Dr. John Langabane de Dube, as you all know. Because it was actually his activism as the first respondent to the formation of the South African National Congress, which later became the ANC, African National Congress. And he responded to the enactment of the Native Land Act number 27 of 1913. It is recorded that he was the first person to respond to that. And he even later made recommendations to the Queen of England regarding the plight of the African people as a result of the dispossession of their land by the European settlers. So we come here as the institute that is based on that background, cherishing those ideals. And the issue of land rights for us is specifically the right to restitution and redistribution, which is an important issue of justice and human rights. And we feel that this issue needs to be urgently addressed. But on the same token, we feel that land ownership is not about just owning a piece of land, but for us, it's even about the physical and spiritual connection that people have to their roots. And this is therefore the core of who we are as Africans and as indigenous South Africans. It therefore becomes an emotional issue which cannot be ignored, not even by the statutes that are used to govern land issues. We work deeply with land research, and we work with community development, and we believe that there's no development without the acquisition of land. And development, if it is done in justice, it has to be progressive and inclusive. So the government, we feel that there should be a shift of focus from the current overemphasis on private property rights at the expense of the state's social responsibilities for radical social and economic transformation. If we can refer to the Freedom Charter, the Constitution, and the National Development Plan, all of these embody a vision of the South Africa with a development which is progressive and inclusive. And now we are faced with a situation where poverty, unemployment, and inequality currently affecting the dispossessed and poorest of the poor was deliberately engineered by the colonial and apartheid government through expropriation of their land and livestock without compensation. It is therefore against this background that we feel South Africa and all who lead South Africa should not be apologetic in considering expropriation of land without compensation, because we should actually look back in history to say, how was land acquired in the first place? When we have to consider compensation, how was that land acquired in the first place? So the issue of compensation in restoring land taken away without compensation does not arise. However, compensation has to be considered and is made payable for improvements that whoever owns the land currently has actually taken over in terms of the land improvement. But it should also depend on the circumstances under which the occupier of the land came to be in possession of the land. And these are the questions that we'd like to see the government actually dealing with. It is a matter of course that expropriation with compensation has always been heavily skewed in favor of white landowners who had previously acquired their land through generous grants by the colonial and apartheid government, or through soft or interest-free loans from the land bank. Therefore, it would be prudent of our government today to consider determining compensation benchmarks that take into account the manner of acquisition of the property. that are earmarked for expropriation. For us, it actually has to be a matter of not even looking much at the Constitution, but rather at the expropriation bill to inform the process of looking at the history of the acquisition of land and therefore considering compensation based on those grounds. I give the opportunity to my colleague, Senator Kizer, to address the issue of the case studies, the expropriation of case studies.
Thank you, Chair. I think in terms of that, I do have faith that we should have made the point that my colleague has made. But I will not go into the individual. I have four case studies which just substantiate what she said. But I think I will be only too happy to deal with them in case they do come up in the Q&A session if the House is able.
You don't want even to highlight them so that they, in a Q&A, they can take to zoom in.
I think my colleague has been trying to illustrate the point that the land expropriation with compensation has been heavily skewed towards white landowners in the sense that they could determine the price at which they would give up their land. One such person is Baras Baker. In KwaZulu-Natal, was expropriated by the South African Development Trust, and was paid a sum of 420,000 rand. And then that was later followed up by 30,000 rand. Now you just suppose that with the creation of this cow in your again in KwaZulu-Natal, where black people were dispossessed, and they were paid a measly sum of 36,000. So I think that illustrates the point that my colleague is trying to make. And further on, the land on which the King Shaka Airport is currently standing was appropriated from the other three people, our three. They got nothing at all. Instead, the chief was bought some matchbox houses for, 11 matchbox houses. But the rest of the community was not. So that is the skewness that we're talking about. But anyway, we will deliberate further on that should the need arise.
Is there a turbulence if you want to conclude, ma'am? Or you not?
Thank you, Chair. I would like Professor Makalala to take us through just a brief historical background in terms of land dispossession.
Thank you, Chairperson, honorable members. I think, Chairperson, if we ignore the lessons of history, we will always go astray. The country today known as South Africa was invaded by the Dutch and the British because of acute shortage of land in Europe. That invasion commenced in 1652. It was resisted by the Khoisan. It was resisted by Xhosa people in the Eastern Cape for 100 years. And then it went on until the establishment of the two republics. After that, the indigenous people were put into the native reserves, where they are, and the Europeans all bought agricultural land for themselves. And therefore, this is the background which we should keep in mind. If we are in New South Africa, we should have started with the leveling of the playing field, taking out all the people who are overcrowded in the native reserve, which are broken. The native reserve are broken, and they are stony and hilly, and not suitable for people to stay there. In KwaZulu-Natal, the land boundary commission of 1846, a and later on Zuza and Blair's Deputation Commission of 1902 to 1904, in the Transvaal and the Free State, after the formation of the Republic, all the people were called tenants. No Amakhosi, nothing. And that came only after the Anglo-Boer War, when the British had defeated the Boer Republics. And therefore, if we jump over this, we will not heal the nation. Let us have the leveling of the playing field. And as a matter of fact, Chairperson, this should have been effective if we are talking about a referendum along the lines of Brexit, so that we know where we are standing, and that we know where the people are standing without any debate and defending or whatever. But what I'm saying, Chairperson, is that the people who are in the native reserves were not there, and they are not living communally there.
Thank you, sir. Thank you very much to the Institute. I'm about to close this question. Honorable Tapo, Honorable Swart, Dr. Mulder, Honorable Mente, Honorable Court.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you for the input. At the point of departure, John Malibalele Student Institute doesn't support expropriation with a concentration, correct? Let's say the last page. And however, you appear to be contrary to the code. You made mention of not agreeing with section 25, subsection 7, in relation to cut-off date. But at the same time, you say you don't support this the resolution per se. And then, don't you think, because you did make mention that the critical role of which the late Dr. John Libalele Dube played in the liberation of our people, do you think the institution or the presentation today, in terms of it, are you perpetuating this legacy? And what will be your take, because you made mention of Ingonyama Trust and the traditional authorities. What's your comment on communal land in relation to the process? Thank you.
Thanks, my friend. Thank you, Chair. Thank you for the submission. I don't see any contradiction in your position. You've made it very clear. Yeah, if I understand you correctly, I think he's talking that the present wording Section 25, as you put out on page 14, is sufficient for land reform to be implemented to redress the ills of the past. The issue of the cut-off date is a separate issue, as I understand, as opposed to expropriation issue. That's the first question. Do I understand you correctly? And in fact, what you indicate on the one page is that if there's any uncertainty, a legal opinion should be obtained on the present wording of the section by government. That's the first issue. The second issue relates to your very good recommended interventions, which is such as to make use of the state should use first a comprehensive land order to identify all unused state lands. And you mentioned national, provincial, and local governments before looking at private land. Would you also include in that, besides national, provincial, and local governments, land that is owned by state-owned enterprises? We know Transnet, for example, owns large tracts of land that was purchased at R1 for all of that land, and the Transnet now wants market-related compensation for those types of properties. of an amendment to the Constitution, as the Human Rights Commission has already indicated. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Member.
Thank you, Chair. JLSD, the name that you've made, it was given to a research company belongs to a first person team, and who knows perfectly well the things in this. And your last line that says it simply requires the lawmakers of the land to adopt greater agency in executing their mandate. What is this greater agency you speak to? If you can clarify us this. Because you are giving us two case studies. Two of them, they are standing out. The first person will get compensated $460,000 and the other can get compensated nothing. That is exactly what has been the problem. The problem is that government must compensate people according to what they demand. And the corpus of this country is not adequate to cover such compensation. And I do not know what is the greater agency then that will be more than what the government can afford right now, which is not the expropriation of land without compensation. As well as, if we're talking about the land that's laying fallow, what must happen to those? The colleague of mine is making an example of Transnet. Transnet was a market-related price. Did they take it at market-related price? No, they did not. They take it. They took it for free. They didn't take it on market-related price. The people that took the land before. Even Transnet even bought it for one rand. Today is how much? Do we have that money here in South Africa? We do not have it. We still sit with a huge land redistribution. And that's the problem. And most people are sitting in small pieces of land. You are mentioning that in KZN. We want them to have proper land. We want them to develop. We want them to own factories. We want them to be all over. And my last question, Chair, is what is your take on the scare tactics from business sector and the financial sector pertaining the land issue? Because all these scare tactics, they seek to derail the process of expropriation of land without compensation, which is not going to hurt anyone. No one is going to be hurt out of this process. Instead, we are all going to develop, and we are all going to be much more fruitful and productive in South Africa. Thank you.
Thanks,
Thank you, Chairperson. I would like to thank the Institute for the contribution. The essence of this contribution is in the last paragraph, the last sentence, where you clearly state that in short, expropriation with or without compensation does not require review of the Constitution. Take note of that. Regarding the interpretation of history by the professor, I differ with the professor, but this is not the day to discuss that. We can do that outside the meeting. The question I would like to ask deals with the five examples that you gave in terms of expropriation of past and the amounts paid, what exactly happened there. The point I would like to make with regard to that is, and I know the whole question of communal land is a very sensitive issue, and I understand the history of communal land. But am I right or wrong if I say the first two examples that you mentioned, where people were compensated adequately, in both those cases, those people did have title deeds in terms of their property, and the market value could be put on those properties. The other three examples that you mentioned were communal lands. I'm trying to ascertain, isn't that exactly the problem? Because the argument is being put forward that if we do have title deeds in all respects, that could address that kind of issue. I don't have the answer. I would like to hear from your perspective how you would react to that.
Thank you, Comrade Chair. I'm always astounded what I've objectively called the intellectual timidity. Firstly, you did a good job in giving the historical context. context of how land was lost. Now, when we restore it, it has to be given that the correct political context and meaning. Because then if you don't, then you fall into all sorts of other challenges. Now, secondly, I also find that at the end, you are not able to be precise. We want the compensation. We believe that should be compensation or compensation. You are in between, so to speak. And I'm surprised. I mean, you are coming from a university, but you can't be conclusive. That is, you are not like Stellenbosch. What Stellenbosch said to the Afrikaner, so very definitive. This is what you must do. This is how you must do it. And inform the political needs. Lastly, Chair, once again, from the message, I would imagine that you would have noted that you are responding to a parliamentary process, not to an ANC process. Because you're writing as if you're talking to the ANC and not to parliament. Thank you, Chair.
Right to respond.
Thank you, Chairperson, and to all the respondents to our presentation. I would like to give this opportunity to my colleague Zendo to respond to the questions first, and then we will check as the team.
Names of the members. I would like to concur with the honourable member who said the cut-off date is actually a separate issue, but it is a matter that we raised in our first submission to Parliament in 2016, where we wanted a review of subsection 7 of section 35. Because, as you know, we are a research institution. And we've done a lot of work. We've actually interviewed over 3,000 claimants. And most of these claimants, almost 90% of them, were dispossessed. They can trace their dispossession right to the 18th century. And so they do not qualify in terms of subsection 7 of section 25, meaning that they are excluded. And that is now why we were advocating for the review of the date itself. Because there is a lot of anger, there's a lot of disappointment, there's a lot of anxiety among especially the rural people that were dispossessed prior to the 19 June 1913 Lenin Act. Our legal opinion is actually very clear, although we have not stated it completely for detail. We are saying everything is there in the Constitution, subsection 2A, subsection 3, subsection 4, and it is all clear. It provides for expropriation in the public interest and for public good. And therefore, all we require is that the relevant laws must be boosted in order to allow for expropriation without compensation. And perhaps that is where our recommendation was weak. But we are of the view that expropriation should happen, but it should happen on a sliding scale. To say we consider everything as per section as per subsection 3, the people that are affected and interested, and then we then from zero compensation to 100% market value based on the issues concerned. Transnet land and other state-owned enterprises.
There again, we do not deviate from the fact that we should look at, government should look at how the land was actually appropriated. And based on that, they then should be able to determine what compensation should be paid. We are not of the view that they should now charge 100% market-related rate. We also take into consideration that South Africa, the government, land in government, is presently just about 10% or just about that. But I think if government were to start expropriating its own land, I think it would show seriousness and it would then instill a sense of goodwill among the rest of the citizens. We know that according to the last audit, 72% is sitting in white landowners' hands. So, I mean, if at all government shows goodwill and they are able to show that they are appropriating their own land for public good, then perhaps the whole nation would want. The scare tactics. We have noted that. But we have noted the scare tactics that have been going around. But as we said at the beginning, we are a research institution. What we can do is to put forward to you our findings, because we're dealing with over 3,000 people and there's a lot of anxiety out there. It doesn't matter how many scare tactics go around, but we need to go through this process. And our advocacy is that it must go through, we must go through it with a transparent and fair manner. And that can be endorsed by legislation that is clear and transparent. As opposed to the case studies that I gave you, I do agree with you that the tragedies make all the difference in this case. But dispossession is dispossession. And whereas other people do not suffer from it, there's a vast majority that has that, and that has got to be put right. It is not right that 72% of the land is sitting in the land, whereas the majority of the people will be out there, we've interviewed that, and we believe this has to be right. And this is all the information we can give you, and then you can shut up the meeting.
Thank you, Chair. I wouldn't say much about what the paper presented, but I heard the Honorable colleague talking about timidity. Well, it's correct, but I don't think in a matter of this case there can be such a timidity. Speaking as a historian, I know that people who are said to be in colonial land were not there because they were defeated and driven to those barren territories, not where they were. Throughout South Africa, I have written a book which is based on the Atari men throughout South Africa. All of them were driven where they were, and the whites took the test, and they were commissioned about that. And therefore, that is the issue where we should start when we deliberate about this. Because when we jumped about and we forget history, and then now all what our conclusion will be completely clouded because we do not see what is the criminal land. In what we went to see, the communal land is not the criminal land. Dr. Stenger, who
was a surveyor general, was instructed in South Africa in 1846, where no European could ever stay. And the same surveyor general, F.S. Mosser, in Zululand Land Delimitation Commission, was instructed to do the same. And that is where they are up to now. And if we talk about Tunisia, it's only a matter of life, it can be very sad. Here, the Khoisan resisted, but they were wiped out when the smallpox contaminated close stream with the ship. And on wearing them, they all died, only one tenth of them. And where is the land? The land was taken over by the European people. And I say, in the two republics, they didn't allow anybody who was called a chief or Indun. They said everybody is a tenant. And therefore, all the people who were there were tenants. It's only the British after the end of World War in 1899-1922 who said, we will use our system of appointing chiefs. So if you go to the Transvaal, the whole of Transvaal, all the people were there and they were involved in semi-slaves. Because all the farms which had no people, they were forced to go and occupy them. In KwaZulu-Natal, it's Bano, people, all the chiefs were forced to go and what's called and went there by force. That was semi-slave. So that is history. But I say, Honorable Good, if we are not talking about history, then of course there will be a lot of talk and talk. And we will not heal. We will not heal the nation, because we have to iron out the wrongs which were done, historically speaking. Now, of course, I say if we are talking about something else, about the law of Section 25 and so on, of course, we will talk in sections and people will rot where they are, where they were damned, because that's where they were damned.
All right, so I think you've answered. I want to thank you, John Langalevalele Tubi Institute. We want to thank you for making yourselves available and request to appear before the committee to enrich this process on the question of possible amendment to Section 25. Without compensation, thank you very much for your effort. One we ask to go to the Kingdom.
Since we are an independent organization, we are SACA-LICA, and we have about 12,000 members countrywide, mostly concentrated in the small and medium-sized enterprises, and that is who we are. May I continue? By my side, Mr. Chairperson, is Professor Koos Malan. He is a professor of public law at the University of Pretoria, and he has written frequently and acted on numerous occasions in constitutional matters, and he's a contributor to our submission. Sakalika exists with the conviction that, and that this is as it should be, that the nature of commerce is seeking out mutual interests and acting in a way where both parties gain something. It's the nature of business, and it's to end up where the sum of the cooperation is greater than the part. So this is the basis of economic growth. The respected post-war German economist Wilhelm Röpke reminded us that the market, though, does not exist in vacuum. The market, he said, a market economy is a form of economic order that is correlated to a concept of life and a social moral pattern. It can thrive only as part of and surrounded by a civil, constitutionally and community-oriented social order. Socialism's aim is able to advance a constitutional order in the interests of its members and in the common interest of its members in business. It is fundamentally with a view to this question of the future of a community, civil, constitution-oriented social order in South Africa that we accepted this invitation by this committee and that we are grateful to be its chair. I should point out that we make this presentation in good faith, although the matter has been to some extent prejudged by presidential announcements, it is still up to this committee to make a recommendation and for which history will hold them accountable. To define the scope of our comments, the question on which this committee seeks our input is whether the Constitution should be amended to facilitate expropriation without compensation, and if so, how. Now, we have submitted in our written submission on various aspects to this question, including constitutionalism, international law, economics, and matters of fact and statistics. But today, we wish to stress, and this is within our competencies, on the constitutional and economic aspects. I wish to make 3 points. The first is, in order to answer the question that the committee has asked our inquiry, we should first understand the question. The first one is, what is a constitution? The question is, should the Constitution be amended to facilitate expropriation without compensation? The first part is, what is a Constitution? Is it any legislative text that passes through formal requirements such as consultation, deliberation, referendum, and or are carried by a stipulated majority in a legislative body such as Parliament? And is public opinion or even a parliamentary majority sufficient for a constitutional amendment? The answer is no. There are fundamental requirements to constitutionalism itself. Texts, even those calling themselves constitutions, that would be in breach of constitutionalism itself, would fail to be a legitimate constitution insofar as they are in breach. This applies to the text of any constitution as well as its interpretation by any constitutional court or other body of judges. Professor Malan shall elaborate on this point after I'm finished. Two, the second question is, what is expropriation without compensation? Now, legally speaking, expropriation is a concept that is always linked to some form of remedy, payment for the property according to what it is worth at a certain point in time. And since the question before this committee is decidedly not about takings accompanied by compensation, the question is raised whether what is considered to carry the name of expropriation. In truth, the term expropriation is mistaken, I submit. The correct term when a taking constitutes an act of zero compensation is confiscation. And insofar as any act of expropriation is with compensation but below market value, the shortfall is always and also a confiscation. My second point is that we are really therefore dealing with a different question, or let's say a more fundamental question apparently has not, which is, in practice, whether, not whether and how the Constitution should be amended to facilitate expropriation without compensation, but rather, can the Constitution be changed to allow for confiscation? Will it remain a legitimate constitution, or will it simply maintain a constitutional form because it is in violation of constitutionalism itself, some deeper properties of law? In order to recommend a change, this committee would have to answer the question in the affirmative. You have to say yes, it can. But I should leave it to Professor Milan to point out why the answer should be in the negative. My third point is that this committee is in a very difficult position. It has to make a recommendation that will carry unfortunate and unwanted consequences either way. If this committee were to recommend that the Constitution can, in fact, be so amended, then we would have to take cognizance of the emerging consensus among local and international commentators and business people that the similarities between South Africa and Zimbabwe are becoming steadily more than the differences. Thankfully, there are still many dissimilarities. But should this committee recommend a change to the constitutional text to allow for confiscation, will facilitate the consolidation of that local and international consensus, not only among commentators and business people, but among concerned citizens in general, and that is that South Africa isn't on the same route as Zimbabwe. Not there yet, but committed to repeating those same mistakes. In this case, it would be incumbent upon all constitutionally minded people to put all their efforts behind restoring constitutionalism. As never before, they should do this. And they should then propose those who undermine constitutions. And while this opposition would be morally necessary, it will lead to great tension between what should be harmonious relationships between various communities in South Africa. As a business organization, SACLIHA will act to play the greatest role it possibly can to maintain such good relations as there should be, but at the same time to restore the foundations, order and prosperity. But the Constitution, this Constitutional Review Committee could also recommend that the Constitution should not be changed, the cannot be so changed. And then there would be the difficult task of dealing with the expectations, the radical expectations that have been raised now, they say, 34 places across the country. In public debate, we see houses in affordable housing markets slumping down to 40% slumps in sales. These expectations are not going to go away. They will have to be dealt with responsibly. But the committee will have to take that, I suppose, into account. And that leaves us then with the alternatives we would have to pursue, which is the long and hard way. History is not a keen business. It's not a keen cut business. But if you want to change the future with more urgency and competence, and we should rejuvenate our efforts in the areas of restitution, in the areas of farmers really doing with mutual goodwill between themselves, as we had seen at Bela Bela 2 weeks ago, projects for the emergence of farmers across various groups in South Africa. There would be title deeds, the need for title deeds would have to be acted upon. There's room for the privatization of state land. All those alternatives need to be explored with great urgency and competency in order to counter the backlash that would rise if this committee does say the Constitution cannot and should not be so amended. I shall conclude and then hand over to my colleague. And this is to say that SACLIHA has asked this committee not to amend the text of the Constitution to facilitate confiscation. It will fail to be a legitimate constitutional document insofar as it is in such a way. There are those who argue that the current constitutional text can be interpreted to allow for confiscation, and that therefore it should be changed. But if this committee does want to make a recommendation that it that the constitution should be changed, and I think it should be that ambiguity should be removed from the current text of the constitution, so that confiscations are unacceptable, partial or in whole. I can conclude that SACA Lichal realizes the difficult position this committee is in, and any of the parties and politicians and parliamentarians involved. But without a constitutional order, the market economy cannot exist. And without a market economy, there is no prospect for South Africa as a thriving country. As Rutger elaborated, the real role of property cannot be understood unless we see it as one of the most important examples of something part of a much wider significance. And that much wider significance is what is deliberated in this.
And a dependent consumer and not a citizen. So the idea of as a result of a lack of a lack of having access to the property, which should be addressed through making it possible for such people to get access to the property, not the opposite. Private property is also a prerequisite for institutions of civil society. Institutions of civil society on their part can only independent if they have members which have the freedom, also based on the fact that they are private property owners who participate in organizations of civil society, which can fulfill their crucially important function of serving, of serving as a check and a balance against one another, and very important to also add a check upon another. As a matter of fact, more important to check upon the balance on the hand of the first problem that comes to.
Thank you, thank you, Prof. Another second question.
Driven land reform just does not exist. Everything should just be left to the market to decide what happens. And that's how I'm understanding it to be the essence of your presentation. Thank you.
Chair. Chair, I just want to just clarify something. That we are facing a difficult, we are in a difficult position. We are not in a difficult position. And the fact that there has been an announcement by the President on the basis of the AFC, that's their part, the AFC part. The EFF pronounced its own position as well. So we are in no difficult position in the community. We're looking at that. Chair, what I would like to understand from the two gentlemen is the issue of constitutionalism and the amendment. The constitution can be amended, and that constitution, us amending the constitution to expropriate the child compensation is constitutional. It doesn't break anything from the principle of constitutionalism. And from where I'm sitting, you are saying the people in Kanyu, the people in Jones Lobo, the people in Jogin, here in the Western Cape where you come from, they must just stay there. There mustn't be any provision for them to ever be human beings. They must be treated inhuman like the way they are right now. The Constitution must not be touched because the legitimacy of that Constitution is going to be questioned. That's what you are saying. So we must leave them subdued if they are in Ethiopia, in Ghana, in Ethiopia, simply because we must not touch the Constitution and talk about the issue of the land. And lastly, the issue of you are saying in the, it's under Part 4, the dying of investment. It's not proven. We have not expropriated without compensation. Right now we are sitting with willing buyer, willing seller. The investment is at what it is. The level of who comes in and who goes out of South Africa in terms of investment is what it is. And it's not informed by expropriation. I do not understand you saying dying of investment based on what. It's dying based on what. We haven't done it. But what we have is people suffering, having no land. And you are saying no, the status quo must remain. So those people must say they do not care about them. I must correct that. Amendment of the Constitution is constitutional and it's legitimate. That Constitution will remain legitimate, a legitimate document that I can just can't stay with.
Another person?
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Thank you for the presentation. And just to start off with, since the Constitution has been enacted, it's been amended 16 times. Now you want to prevent it, so we shouldn't tamper with the Constitution. My question to Sakalika is that your members are beneficiaries of land in South Africa. That goes without saying. But I wonder, shouldn't you be reflecting on the role played by your members, those businesses, the role they played which led to inequality? This is what land does. When you're dispossessed of land, you are then unequal to the other people. In fact, you do not have the same economic power as those people who own the land. So you should reflect on the role played by your members in terms of bringing about that inequality. And so let's say in your little wet dream, you don't amend the Constitution, which we will do. We don't amend the Constitution. How will business change its behavior? How will your members change their behavior? And I say this because you also oppose the mining charter, and you have members who want the mining industry. And if you look at what mines have done in terms of damaging the environment, forcibly removing people, and also being involved in you listen to national terms. How would you change your behavior if we were not to amend this constitution? And also, lastly, I want to caution you against the irresponsible use of the word confiscation. It's very different from amendment to expropriate. There's no use of confiscating people's land. That is very irresponsible. You know, you said the government would be irresponsible to confiscate land. I think that is another scare tactic that Sarkozy is using. Thank you very much.
That is another person who's afraid of using the hard language. Make your point intellectual. I'm talking to professors. All right,
Chair, I'd like to thank the presenters for the comprehensive document and the manner of your presentation, which I welcome. I would also like to welcome the fact that you have indicated a willingness to dialogue and to maintain good relations and to find a solution to this issue, which on the one hand is causing great hope to certain sectors of the communities, but on the other hand causing great anxiety on the other hand. And the South Africans need to find a way forward to find a resolution to this issue. Now just on the issue of the constitution itself and the possible amendment of it, we know we've got a very independent judiciary, and a very strong judiciary, a very strong constitutional court. Would you not agree that if there was to be an amendment, and it was to be tested, it will be tested in the constitutional court, whether that if it is so that you are concerned that it goes to the foundations of the constitution, the constitutional court might say that it infringes upon chapter 1 of the constitution and requires a higher threshold. So if they're not built-in checks and balances in our constitution already, as we consider a possible a way forward to deal with this next issue. Secondly, you also mentioned the issue of restitution. Would you elaborate on the issue? If did I understand you correctly, you mentioned that there's a process of how to deal with the issues that we're faced with at the moment. And I think, if I understood you correctly, you referred to the Restitution of Land Act. But elaborate, because it indicates to me that you are not without sympathy to the present situation of many people in South Africa. Thank you.
Thank you, Lena.
I should leave some of the questions to my colleague. And I'll start with the second question on do we see any room for public-driven land reform? And I'll combine this with Noble Schwartz's question. There is definitely a room for public-driven land. But there are many reasons, and for various reasons, that people are currently supporting land reform. For some people, it's a matter of justice. And when it's a matter of justice, then the correct remedy is restitution. That is why we support the restitution process, as everybody should do, because it is about 3 years taking that was unjust, with or without compensation. And insofar as it wasn't with proper compensation, it was a confiscation rate. So the restitution process is, in our minds, all settled and should continue. I mean, it's not finished. There's no question to discuss. It's not just to be rectified. For some people, it's all a matter of equality. And that's a very ideological way of going about things, to say, well, everything should be equally divided. This is a totally different question. The one is a question of justice, and the other is a question of social engineering. This is not to say that there are more or less desirable patterns of land ownership, that we want to criticize one another. But to set equality as a goal is something completely else. There are various other ways in which land reform should and can be pursued. One is, of course, restitution. The other is the kind of goodwill we saw between various farmers at their projects at the showcase at Bella Bella 2 weeks ago. There are pre-market land reforms, significant reform, both in urban and rural and agricultural land, in pre-market ways. And then those are a few of the examples. But none of them necessitates, and this is why some things to belabor the point, none of them necessitates confiscation. So the question before this committee is not whether land reform should be pursued, but whether there should be confiscation. And to that the answer should be no. And the term decidedly should be confiscation. We elaborated our presentation on why that is so, and two very competent legal scholars has explained for that reason. It is important to note that our submission in no way is about condemning people to townships or as some members have put it, but it is about protecting the order within which property rights and a market economy can exist so that there can be active citizenship, so that people have freedom and the means to move around. Have the freedom and the means to seek out their dreams and realize them, and to be active citizens so that they can contribute to a better society and can act when necessary as a check on government power. That is what this is. The current dispensation is decidedly not one of willing buyer, willing seller. It's one of willing buyer, willing or not seller. That is not what this question is about. The question is about when there is an expropriation, should it be with compensation or not? And there are, in the public, for a public purpose, quite internationally and locally, set examples of expropriation, even if the seller wasn't willing, but the compensation is marked. I shall to put this one
up. I shall try to deal with all the aspects not having been dealt with. First, does the Constitution at the moment, in given circumstances, leave limited circumstances allow for compensation without, for expropriation without compensation, that is for confiscation? It does. However, and that is obviously a matter to be considered from case to case, but clearly that will be in limited circumstances. So I share that view. But to the extent that that is so, if that could be allowed towards, if that could be allowed in relation to a property owner who has legitimately claimed to be the owner of that land, then it's actually a problem.